What's up, Commit or Quit family? This is Eric Nam.
This is Eddie Nam.
And we're back with another great episode of Commit or Quit, where our guests bring us their favorite movie or TV show recommendations.
Haha, that's right. Our guest today is a pretty big deal, and we're so thrilled to have him on this podcast.
Yeah, this man has directed some major films and blockbusters from Step Up 2, Step Up 3D, Justin Bieber's Never Say Never, G.I. Joe Retaliation, and of course, one of our favorite movies, the 2018 hit rom-com Crazy Rich Asians, and he's also directing the much-anticipated film adaptation of In the Heights.
We got John M. Chu in the house today. The three of us had a great time talking about John's life, his projects, as well as the new buzzworthy Netflix film, The Half of It. And we can't wait for you to hear this one.
All right, then, without further ado, here is our enthralling, amazing conversation with Mr. John M. Chu.
Let go.
Hey, what do you want to watch?
I don't know.
Oh, I actually heard this is really good.
What do you say? Should we commit or quit?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, commit or quit family, please welcome to the show. We got Mr. John M. Chu. Hey, John, how are you?
What's up? It's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. We're excited to have you.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here. You disrupted my swimming with my daughters. But I also got to escape that too. So now my wife gets to get them out and get them all dry.
So. Oh, man. So how have you been? You're in isolation in LA.
Yeah.
Right? With family.
Thank God I'm in LA and not, I was in New York for all year, pretty much all last year. Escaped here a few weeks ago. So it's nice to have an actual pool, an outdoor area.
Right. Right. Yes. How has it been? I mean, I don't have any kids, so I don't really know.
Yeah.
But from all my friends who have kids, they're like, I need to get away from these kids. I love my kids to death, but I need some time. How have you been?
You know, I feel very lucky because my kids aren't in school, so I don't have to be a teacher all of a sudden. I just have to keep them busy. So my options are a little wider. We can go on walks. I can, not big walks, obviously, but we can go on little adventures through our hallways and turn off the lights and play ghosts and things like that. So I'm very lucky. So I have a 9-month-old and a almost 3-year-old.
Okay.
So, and we got some stuff done. Willow, my oldest, she got potty trained during this time, which one day when you have children, you'll know that it's nice to actually be around and have a bathroom very close when you're doing that training.
Sure.
And then my little one, the one that was born last year while I was shooting In the Heights, his name is Heights. He just started to crawl about 48 hours ago. So our whole thing is about to change now that we have two movers.
Oh my gosh. So, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure it's great that you get to see them, and be with them as they're going through these really developmental times,
Yeah, yeah. I mean, honestly, my son Heights, who was literally born while we were shooting, I have not really gotten to know because I've been shooting and I've been editing. And so this is actually a great time to let him know that I'm his dad, that I'm around. It's when you're doing a movie, when you're a director for a movie, you have waves, as you guys know as entertainers as well, where you're working really hard and then you have like dead time. So it's really nice to catch up with the family at this time.
Well, that's great to hear you're doing well and you get to spend time with family. I'm a little curious, we have so much, you have such a illustrious resume of things that you've done and accomplished. But since you brought it up, In the Heights, it's something that I think so many people are really excited to see, excited to experience, when it's ready. Could you talk to us a little bit about it? Productions, pre's done, you've shot, are you in post right now? What's going on?
Yeah, we finished shooting it. I finished editing it. We are just mixing it, which for a musical, is a musical written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. He wrote it before Hamilton. It was a Broadway show. Mm-hmm. We have all new music, all new score, all new orchestrations for the movie. And so the mix of it where we mix the dialogue, the sound effects, the music itself, Foley, all that stuff together. That's such a huge undertaking for us. And we had we were probably like 3 days into like a 6 week mix when we got shut down and got sent home because of the virus. So we have about 6 or 7 weeks left. And we don't know when we're going to do that since our movie got pushed till next June 16th, Father's Day, 2021.
Now I got time.
I went from like, it's like running a marathon.
Yeah.
And then like 6 miles before you're done, they're like, stop, go home. And so your adrenaline's still running, your mind's still moving.
Yeah.
So
in terms of, you know, professional stuff, you know, outside of In the Heights and that kind of stuff, what have you been working on? Are you looking at new projects? Are you still producing things? Are you, what's going on?
Well, I have a new television deal at Fox Disney. Congratulations. So we are developing stuff for ABC, for Disney Plus, for Hulu, for Freeform, FX, a bunch of different shows there. So, I haven't done a lot of television. I did a show for Apple TV Plus this just recently, so I'm excited to play around in the TV world a little bit. In terms of my other movies, I'm developing Crazy Rich Asians 2, and some other movies that I don't know which one will go next, and maybe there'll be another one that sweeps in there for my next movie. But I know for now I'm sort of taking a little bit of time just to focus on TV, get In the Heights out of here. And then we'll see where we end up.
Man, busy man, so busy. Yeah.
It's been nuts, but a blessing. You know, I know there's a lot of people out of work. A lot of people don't know what they're doing next. And even in our industry, crews need help, and people. It's just so many industries don't know what is next.
Right.
By the way, me included. Like, who knows? I'm hoping we'll keep making movies, but you never know.
Right.
I'm just not taking anything for granted. And and it's actually really hard to be creative right now. I don't know about you guys. You guys are probably just always going. But for me right now with kids, it's hard to do like 30 minutes of creativity and then like 4 hours of like just trying to survive. So that's been hard. But I think we're getting into a rhythm now.
Right. Yeah, I found that once I've just accepted that this is going to go on a lot longer than we would all think. It's been a lot better. I think it's like every day there's just this giant question mark of a TBD.
Yeah.
Hey, let's get this done. When are we going to get it done? We don't know. And then everyone's just frazzled. But I don't know. Totally. We're definitely getting in a rhythm right now.
Even right now, like as things start to open up, I think there's so many, like it makes you feel like everything's back to normal. And then you see how many people are dying every day. And you're like, it's not back to normal. It just, you know, means there's more room in hospitals for you if you get sick. I'm sure so many people are struggling with the back and forth of emotional whiplash of our things.
Yeah.
But things aren't the same and they won't be for a long time. So we'll see how it all goes. But at least we're all in this together. We all have each other, even though we're separated right now. And
we got each other we have these conversations to help people get through them, we like to think. You know?
Yeah. And I think for us to tell people that they're not alone in that in between place, and that even us, we are also stuck and we also are powerless at this moment. And in The Heights, there's a moment that happens in the movie where there's a blackout. And Washington Heights, where the movie takes place, they don't get their power back for many, many days. And everyone gets depressed and sad. And you know, when I was directing the movie, I guess this happens in New York. I did not know about blackouts that much, other than like, I've been through a blackout. But like, blackouts are a thing, especially in Washington Heights. There have been some crazy incidences with blackouts. So now, and in the movie, you know, one of the salon ladies who is moving their salon out of the neighborhood because they can't afford that area, as she's moving out, everyone's still depressed. So she goes in and cheers everybody up. And says, like, get off your butts and stop feeling sorry for yourselves. Like, you can be down, and it's fine to be down, but now's the time to pick yourself up and be proud of who you are and raise your flag, and let's go make hell out there. We are not, she said, we are not powerless. We are powerful. And so in a weird way, we are all going through a blackout right now. We're all separated and trying to figure out a new normal, and we can be down. And that's fine. And there's a certain point we got to pick ourselves up. Right. Whether that's now or later, I don't know yet, but I find it very encouraging to know that other times in history we've had to do this. And so mm-hmm. our generation and your generation and other generations can do this. And I'm excited because when I watch TikTok and see how creative people are, I see YouTube, I see you guys creating this. There's no bounds to how creative we could be in any situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree. You know, I think, you know, I haven't spoken to you much before. I feel like this is the first time we're really connecting. But I was watching your TED Talk and I was reading a lot of your interviews and even just in this short period of time, just the general vibe I get from you is that you're an incredibly uplifting person in the way you speak, the way you choose your words and you frame things. And I think that comes across also in the movies and the projects that you've taken on. I feel like In the Heights is probably one of those movies as well, but so was Crazy Rich Asians. And I think for a different reason, it was an uplifting moment for Asian and Asian Americans that I think resonates with people all around the world and people got so excited for it. So I wanted to ask you, when we look at Crazy Rich Asians and the immense amount of success that it had, I think for a lot of people, we're like, this is it. This is a great moment. This is a time in history where we will be able to point and say, this changed the way Hollywood or entertainment started viewing Asians or Asian Americans. Where do you think we are two years after Crazy Rich Asians? Yeah. And where do you think we will be going? How have you felt? What is your pulse on this?
Well, let's be very clear. We did not start that movement. We did not, it wasn't because of us specifically. Mm-hmm. We were a part of a much bigger movement. We just made a movie. And we made a movie that was only possible because of a movement that was already happening before us. You know, there are a lot of rule breakers and trailblazers that led the way, of course, over all the years. But more recently, in the last several years, that really also changed my brain to gear me towards making that movie, that gave me the idea to pursue that movie. You know, I remember looking online and reading the sort of hashtag starring John Cho stuff, or Oscar So White. Those things, I was never, you know, when you're Asian American making movies in Hollywood, the last thing you want to be labeled is someone other. You want to be in, and you want to be the one that everyone goes to. And so, so as a individual growing up in that, because I got into it pretty young, I avoided confronting my cultural identity crisis on purpose. And part of it was because I was too scared to. I didn't have the answers. I didn't know there was how many people out there would understand what I'm talking about. And these networks started to happen. I mean, CAPE has been around, but like the actual sort of younger people at CAPE started to hang out and people started to work and you started to notice people like, oh, I recognize them from that TV show. Oh, I recognize them from that thing, from that as a sportsman or a musician or whatever it was. And I remember going to one of those events. This was probably 2 or 3 years before Crazy Rich Asians, and looking around and being like, oh, this is a different chapter. Like, I actually look at these people around me and I'm starstruck by many of them. And so it dawned on me that something was shifting already. And then when I saw the starring John Cho, and I thought I was not part of that. I was just an observation as someone who was making movies in the movie business. And then I watched the starring John Cho sort of stuff happen, William Yu, on Twitter. And it was, I could physically feel my brain shift. You know, when you see John Cho in a poster, you're like, yeah, that makes total sense. He should be in that movie. And then the more you look at it, you're like, why isn't he that guy yet? Why isn't he? Has all the pieces. We have all the things. And yet that actually, I've never seen that image before. Suddenly I realized like, oh, because we've been told he can't do that. Like it didn't compute to me. And that's where I realized, oh yeah, Hollywood's messed up. Something is keeping stuff something out. And then I realized, oh, I'm a part of that. And I've been in those rooms where they say, you can't cast those two as romantic leads. It doesn't sell internationally or doesn't do this, or like American audiences wouldn't really buy tickets to that. Or it's just too niche. Like I have literally heard those words. And I believe those because I was young. And when the people who are in charge tell you that, hey, right. look at the numbers, then you believe that. And that's what they follow too. I don't think they're evil. I just think that they believe those things. And so I realized there was an opportunity. I knew that I had done enough movies. I could make a movie, any movie I wanted. And so I should choose what that movie would be very carefully. And I wanted to do something personal, but I didn't want to do my own story. And when I read Crazy Rich Asians, it had a piece of my story that wasn't my story, but this Asian American going to Asia for the first time and going through that identity crisis was very familiar to me. And also it was a woman. So Rachel Chu, it was one step removed from me. And so I felt very safe to explore this idea. And the point of it also was to not give a answer really of which part of your personal identity you should be leaning into. It's everybody has their own choice. And our generation gets to choose what that mix feels like. And the next generation gets to choose what that feels like. So that's sort of where it all started. So the fact that people actually, and I thought no one was going to see the movie necessarily. So the fact that people saw it, and by the way, I knew it was going to be a movie because when I knew already the actors, like I already knew Constance could be a great person, Jimmy O Yang, Ronnie Chang, Sonoya. I mean, I knew, we didn't know Henry. Henry was a discovery, but we knew all these others that the world had not given them the opportunity to show off. Awkwafina, of course. So to see the world rediscover them or discover them really as in their powers and then see them go off and make other movies. To me, that again was a result of a bigger path put on by other people. And it allowed this existing network of people to come and rally around something. It could have been anything, but it was us. And it could have been anyone, but it was this group of actors who were so talented and that could laugh at ourselves, which no one else, someone else wasn't making the joke about us. We were making the joke about ourselves. They were confident as hell, which I think sometimes we lack because we don't know our self-worth. And the movie, it's called Crazy Rich Asians. It's not about worth of money. It's your self-worth. And so I think all those things made a perfect storm to make this happen. And so I love seeing that it finally gives Hollywood a data point to kill all their fallacy about what you can cast and what you can't. And we hope within The Heights, we do that again. And we can just do it again over and over and over again. It doesn't mean it's fair that we have to keep proving it, but we do. And we're here and we have the talent to do it. So I love seeing all these other filmmakers tell other stories because our story is very specific. It's a romantic comedy. It has a certain thing. But to see everybody else tell their story, that's the big win. Is now everyone gets to tell the story and other people get to lift and carry us forward.
And John, I think when you're talking about how this started really bubbling up organically in the old school and the new school, like the Gold Open started happening.
I've known Bing for years, by the way. Yeah. So to see him finally like have this waving moment to be able to like do it and get out. Yes, it's awesome. Yeah.
He was made for this. But I just wanted to say, as this whole thing happened and like, you know, Eric was doing part of the Gold Open in Korea. And, you know, this was something that, you know, Eric's been very vocal about also just on the music side and representation. But thank goodness, thank God, the movie was like exceptional. You know what I mean? Like the worst thing on the music side across entertainment, the worst thing that can happen for us is when we support it and we push it and we're like, this is it. This is it. And it's not a product worth paying for or checking out. And so when that all fell into place, I was like, oh my goodness, this is awesome. John, you're a legend. The casting, amazing. We were so excited.
So easily gone the other way, guys.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
But honestly, I think that's the thing. It's like, as an artist, we have to work on our crafts first and foremost. If you're an actor, you're a musician, like get amazing at your craft and no one can deny you. You are a piece of value and they need you. You don't need them. And so we don't have to change the world, us as artists. And maybe that's for other people in our community to really make a big ruckus online and push their things and do the things and get the financing in line. But as artists, if we just keep focusing on making better things, entertaining things, then and they're doing their work, then us as a community can really make lots of strides really quickly, because you can't deny good craftsmanship.
Yeah. I'm personally incredibly excited for the next 10 years, because I think with Crazy Rich Asians, with like even BTS and all these different, you know, Asian American things that keep popping up, we have younger people, younger generation, who can look to these people and say, I can do that. Let me work at this craft. Let me become the best actor or singer or comedian that I could possibly be. Whereas I felt like when I was growing up, I was just going against the grain. I was like, I've never seen anything like this, and it's probably never going to happen. So I'll just quietly do it on YouTube and in my bathroom or something. So I'm really excited. Yeah. If anything, this is, we've built to a place where it sets us up very well for the next 10 years and beyond, hopefully.
100%. And I think the younger generation also has less of the baggage that that I definitely had. I have less baggage than what my older brother and sister had, because you know, they have more fears and more things, insecurities. Right. So I have a little less. I think you guys have less than that. Mm-hmm. And it just keeps going. And I think that that's you're right. I think that that's the really exciting part.
Speaking of, you know, kind of growing up and your family, you're the youngest of five kids.
Yes.
And your parents.
So I'm used to chaos.
You're used to the chaos. But I was reading, it seemed like your parents were very supportive of you pursuing film and TV and that kind of stuff. But is there something in you when you think back on it, or even now, when was it and what was it that said, I need to make films, I need to make movies, or I need to do this type of art?
Yeah. I think when you're the youngest of five, you got to fight for your food. You got to fight for your space. You got to fight for your toys. You got to fight for being heard. And when I was sort of a spastic, weird kid, I loved to draw. I loved to play with my toys. I was definitely spoiled. So I would have week-long adventures with my toys in my backyard, which I'm sure is where I learned my storytelling. But I think I didn't get serious about it until I saw this mixer, this video mixer in Sharper Image, which will, I don't know, you guys may be too young, but there's this magazine called Sharper
Image. I definitely know what Sharper Image.
Okay, good. Phew. All right. And in there was this thing you could connect like VCRs to and put your stereo to, and you could edit stuff together. And I didn't know how to edit, but I thought that was so cool. So I convinced my dad to buy it. I told him I'd make, because he has a restaurant, Chinese restaurant. So I said I'd make him like videos for his cooking class and stuff, because he had a cooking class. I never did those. But he bought me the thing, and I made a video of one of our vacations, cutting us all together with music. And when they watched it, they cried. Mm. And it was the first time I felt like, well, one, I had stayed up for 3 days straight editing it. And so there was this release. It was like very visceral, staying up all night to make something that I really loved. And then the satisfaction of moving people, of seeing that they could see me or hear what I was trying to create, that changed everything for me. I knew I was going to do it for the rest of my life from then on. Mm-hmm. I knew I could not stop, actually, more than anything else. And even to this day, like, people ask me, well, what's the movie? Is there one movie that you, if you had any movie to do, what would that be? And I just don't have an answer to that question, because that's not my relationship with making movies. Making movies to me is a process. It's like breathing. I need it to let out the demons in my head, or let out the stuff that's like there. And I can then live my life. So I will always make stuff, and I don't know what I'm going to make next. I don't know ever. Mm-hmm. It's always sort of like whatever, wherever I am is what I'm making. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, to me, whether someone's paying me or not, whether my career fails, I will always be making videos. Because if it's not a movie, I'll be making a wedding video for somebody, or a memory video for someone's 50th anniversary. I don't know. So it's very much a process for me that I need.
That's great. Were there particular movies or directors or anybody that you looked up to growing up that really inspired you or formed the way you create?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot. I would say, I mean, animation was something that I love. Oh, so I would okay. say Disney animated musicals. If you look at any of my movies, I probably steal a lot of my shots from there. Spielberg movies, E.T., Goodfellas, I watched a lot. But certain things like Run Lola Run changed my brain. I think I was in high school. I was just getting into college. That changed my brain about how movies can feel and how they can be structured. Obviously, Pulp Fiction at that time also did that. I mean, half the people in my film school were there because of Pulp Fiction. And so I think those movies really shook my brain that there was still more to do in the cinema business. So
that's awesome. I mean, we're so excited to have you here because you're the first director to join us on this. And so when we reached out, part of the great thing about having actors on is that, you know, they have their perspective of like, oh, this scene was really cool because it was acted in this way, or this character took on this type of life. And today you wanted to talk about a new movie. It's called The Half of It, which is a new Netflix original. And so I had been looking forward to watching it, and you gave me an excuse to watch it. But as we dive into this movie, I'm really excited to hear kind of your insights and what you took away from somebody who's in the field, who's lives and breathes this kind of stuff. So if it's okay with you, we'll just dive right into this movie, right?
Let's do it. And I'm really excited to talk about this movie because Alice Wu, who wrote and directed it, I got to know, she's a trailblazer herself by doing that movie Saving Face. I think it was in 2005, which really was way ahead of its time. And then she didn't make another movie until this. And I would see her outside the edit room because I was editing In the Heights while she was editing this movie. I was starstruck when I talked to her. She's from the Bay Area, so she's from my same town. She's been to my parents' restaurant many times.
That's crazy.
So I got to know her a little bit there, and I never knew what this movie was because I didn't get to watch it. So I'm really excited because I think the world needs more Alice Wu movies. I think she has more to say, and the world has caught up with her. And I think she's going to have a really amazing career in the next few years, as we'll see what comes out from her.
That's exciting. All right, well, let's jump into it. Alrighty, so John chose the movie The Half of It, written and directed by Alice Wu, and it was just released on Netflix on May 1st. Just so you guys know, there are spoilers in this discussion. And if you don't like spoilers, go watch the movie and come back. But otherwise, think of it as a good opportunity for you guys to get a little taste of what the movie's about. And I personally don't think that this movie, even with the spoilers, I don't think it really affects what you feel and what you take away from it.
True.
Personally. True. So you could still listen to the discussion. We have
some you can know the whole plot.
Yeah.
And not be affected by it because it's actually about how it feels.
Right. It's more about emotions and the things you feel from it than like the actual arch of the story. So Eddie, if you could please read us a Netflix synopsis, please.
Yep. So when smart but cash-strapped teen Ellie Chu agrees to write a love letter for a jock, she doesn't expect to become his friend or fall for his crush.
Oh, man. That was a very good
John, that's kind of like my big… Yeah, that's my big cue.
I like it. Podcast, you're hired. You can do the trailer.
All right. So to break it down for our listeners just a little bit, here's a little more detail. So the movie takes place in a fictional town of Washington State called Squamish. And it centers around three main characters. We got Ellie Chu, we got Paul Munsky, and Aster Flores. And the lead protagonist, Ellie, is a bookish, quiet Chinese-American girl in essentially like an all-white, small, conservative town. She's smart. She's quiet. A great writer. And she writes other students' essays to make money and help support herself and her dad, who is a Chinese immigrant who is way overqualified for his job but can't get a good job because his English is not the best. She is approached by Paul, the main guy character, a football player who, quote-unquote, doesn't speak too good and is clearly not the smartest student, but he's asking Ellie to help write him write love letters to his crush, Aster Flores. That brings us to third main character, Aster, who is the daughter of the town minister, and she is Latina. And she is Latina, but she is dating the school jock and this rich kid named Trig, who runs the town. And she passes as this almost, you know, just like any other person in this major white community, because she's pretty and she's dating the popular kid. And she finds herself questioning her life, meaning of it, what her future is, and going back and forth writing letters to Paul, not knowing that it's actually Ellie. So to keep it a little bit concise, but also just give you the plot, pretty much it's a love triangle. It's Cyrano de Bergerac with a little bit of a twist. It's a little bit of a younger high school LGBTQ plus love triangle where you're kind of watching and you have all these different points where you feel all sorts of different emotions and awkward because everybody's in high school. So that's kind of my take on what this plot is. I mean, John, I guess the first question we should ask is, why did you pick this movie? And what were some of the main things that you really wanted to point out to us in this movie?
Mm-hmm. Well, I picked it because I think Alice Wu is an important filmmaker of right now. And and I think she had something to say in how you tell this story, that it didn't feel like a super small indie arty movie. Like, this was very much going for, or seemed like it was going for, the big audience, the big four quadrant audience, telling a beautiful romantic story, complicated and messy as it is, about love, which, you know, as a young person, you have lots of thoughts about love. And she doesn't simplify it. She takes a very traditional structure of the Cyrano de Bergerac and, like you said, twists it. And I thought that I thought that the honesty of it was really beautiful. And there was a boldness in its simplicity. And I really loved the, I just really loved that it felt, Ellie Chu, played by, Leah Lewis, is so good in this. I think she's such a unique character that I have not seen in an American movie, let alone, a movie that world has access to through Netflix, which is what a great, sort of system now that we have, to make great art. And that it doesn't have to feel like a little arty movie, that it can, that it's not about, being gay. It's about being in love. What that feels like, how confusing that can be. And with family love, friend love, and love. So I loved all those things about it. And I just think her attention, Alice's attention to performances, to the honesty of the performances, and to where she puts the camera. You know, they have these scenes in the confession at the church. I love that Ellie, when she plays the piano for the church, she always has to be on that second level, so the camera has to like move to even know that she's there. There's such like heartbreaking moments. I think the cleverness of texting during the date, where she's trying to get the dude, Paul, to be interesting on this date, is just so fascinating. So anyway, I just thought it's a very unique story and actually execution.
I wholeheartedly agree on that. I think, you know, the first thing that struck me is this character, Ellie Chu, and the actress, Leah Lewis. I've never seen her anywhere. I don't know anything about her.
Yeah, me neither.
But I legit, within the first 10 minutes, I was like, she's a great actress, and she has, I love her voice.
I thought
she had such a nice, pleasant voice, and it was, I don't know. And she also speaks Mandarin, and it was not, it didn't, well, I'm not perfect with Mandarin, but it didn't sound like a cringy kind of thing. Like, and I was like, everything about the way she's portraying this character and delivering the lines just felt so real. And there was an instant connection of just a humanization in part, which as a young Chinese American girl, I've never seen before on screen, I felt like.
Yeah.
And so that for me as an Asian American really just like leapt out. And I was like, okay, let's hear this out. Let's see where the story is going to go. And boy, did it tell a story. Right. Eddie, what did you think?
Yeah, and Eric, going back to her voice, as I was watching the movie, I thought she had such a clear pronunciation and it was very pleasant to listen to. I check her Instagram. She's got all these covers up there. Check it out when you can. She has an amazing voice.
I didn't know amazing that.
I think voice. She was actually on The Voice at some point.
Oh, really? Was she really?
Okay. I thought I read that somewhere.
Okay. I'm so curious now. Okay, but got anyways.
Yeah, but I agree with you, Eric. Like, just seeing a fresh face and an opportunity for somebody to really become a budding star, that was quite cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that her likability is at the center of this whole thing. And actually, the guy who plays Paul, Daniel, is also really likable. Mm. And Alice says is great. She has, when she did Saving Face as well, like both of the performances have such specific little weird things, quirky things. And mm-hmm. she always chooses those takes. And, you know, as a director, you basically, you're a chef, so you get all the ingredients and you can make any movie from it. You can make the mm-hmm. cheesy version of the movie. You can make the obvious version. You can make the subversive, dark version, whatever it is. And Alice takes a very interesting way of mixing humor with heartbreak, with broad jokes, with very truthful moments. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's a very unique thing to have. And even her music that she uses in the movie could have easily been teen pop songs right now. Like,
right.
Just go get the whatever CW mixtape and put it in, and right. you got all these things, and it's the acoustic guitar. But she chose like 80s and 90s music, mm-hmm. And on a exactly. radio, and she found ways to make that happen. And I just thought that was it. There is a maybe because I'm older, but there is a nostalgia, even if they're young, to it. Yep. It made them feel like old souls in a good way. It didn't make them feel like they were out. They were playing a different character. But I loved that touch to it as well.
You know, I'm so glad you point that out, because I was watching it and I literally thought maybe this is like a back in time piece where it's like, because everything about it felt nostalgic. Even like the small town, everybody's on a bike. Like the trucks and the cars there aren't super nice. And the fashion, it looks kind of older. But then everybody has a cell phone. It's current modern day. I thought it did do a great job of pulling in cultural references and like set design and clothing design, where it's like, this is relatable to such a larger audience through the lens of a high school girl, which was so interesting to me.
And I really believe this experience in a small town where you're one of the only Asians, or even if there are many Asians and you're maybe one of the only ones that you know, where you have white friends that are coming mm-hmm. over to your Chinese house and sitting and watching movies with your dad that doesn't speak English or speaks very little English. Like, I've had that experience. I know Alice, coming from the Bay Area, even though it's not a tiny, tiny town, at the time when we were growing up in the 80s and 90s, it felt very small. And so those like cross-cultural moments, I think, are like the next generation's immigrant stories, more than like coming from China, from Taiwan to here. Like, those stories are great, and that's sort of my generation stuff. But to hear a story where it's all here, and we are it's not dealing with coming here, mm-hmm. I just think is very important.
I'm curious, John, in you know, your experience personally growing up, you know, what was that like? When I think of the Bay Area, there's so many Asian Americans, Asian immigrants.
Now, yes.
Right, exactly. But I don't know, when you were growing up, and I guess your parents came much earlier and you're the youngest of five. So there has to be a generational gap between your oldest sibling and yourself as well. But what was that like for you? What was your reality growing up?
Yeah, so my parents came in like 1966, 67, mm-hmm. something like that. I should probably know that date, but I don't. And there was a Chinese community in like San Mateo. That's why they came. It's mm-hmm. like a port. So they came there, and that's how my parents met. But they moved to Los Altos, which is near Palo Alto.
Right.
And to my understanding, I wasn't there, but to my understanding, there wasn't. And our, that Chinese restaurant, Chef Chu's, was one, if not the first Chinese restaurant in that area. So they always have taught us, like, this restaurant is an ambassadorship. Like, we're introduction to Chinese people and Chinese culture. So my mom made us behave. She made us dress well. She took us to shows, made sure we were educated so that, because she always felt like most of these people will get to know Asian people through us. And so we have to show that we are as sophisticated, as, you know, into art and music and all those things as anybody else in this town. So, So that was embedded in us. I know that my older brother is, my oldest brother, who's the oldest, is 6.5 years older than me. So not that much, but that 6.5 years is actually a big, big, gap in terms of cultural, like being the first one in my mom's family of six, you know, mostly sisters she had, and my mom's the oldest. So he was the first grandchild. And everything was on his shoulders. Even to this day, like, he's the golden child. He's the one that they were like, we came here and built this place for. So the responsibility on him is very large. By the time I came around, you know, Chinese was spoken, but more just the bad stuff they didn't want me to necessarily understand. So of course I can understand those things. The other stuff I can't understand. And then, and by the time I came around, you know, my baby books were written all over in crayon. I don't have any pictures in those things. They didn't really pay attention to me that much. So, so I had a different growing up. But even when I was growing up, I was probably in my school, one of the only Asian kids. By the time I graduated, there was tons. But like when I was there, I was one of very few, if a handful, I would say. My school was also very small. So it's not like we had 300 people. It was 50 people per class.
Oh, wow.
And then I went to that same school from kindergarten all the way through high school. So I never felt the, I never felt the cultural pressure necessarily. Also, my parents did become, sort of very prominent in the community. So no one could mess with me. I think that's maybe why coming into USC, coming into LA when I first realized, oh, life isn't like it is in Los Altos, California. That I had a bit more confidence or moxie than maybe somebody else, because I had lived the future. I had lived in a place where, you know, I could do anything. I was, you know, ASB president. My brother was ASB. Like, we were all, my brother was a sports star there. Me, not so much. But I did the lights for the theater company. So
there you go.
So I think that was an eye-opening thing and took me a while to cope with. Maybe till only a Crazy Rich Asians to really cope with. I did one short film about my cultural identity crisis when I was in film school. It was called Guaylo. And I was so scared of that movie. Because I didn't have any answers in that movie. It was just sort of like trying to make some, and so I was so scared of what I made would turn people off that I never really showed it to anybody, to this day. So anyway, so those are sort of the things that I grew up in a kind of a specific thing. And
yeah,
right.
Thank God it's changing. Yes.
I am always thinking about that though. Like, even in this, when Ellie's friend, I'm blanking on his name right now. Is it Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul goes over and he's like eating dumplings and he's doing that. And he's unfamiliar with the culture, but he's not like, he's not being ignorant. He's not saying this is gross. What is this? Like, we've all gone through that. I remember specifically when, you know, banchan in Korean cuisine, you can just like leave it on your counter in these like Tupperware, you know? And
I
remember all my buddies were over in eighth grade and they came and we're all like wrestling downstairs, come up for a little snack, which I imagine in like a Sunkist commercial, you're like, everyone's going to the fridge. A bunch of little sardines and like banchan that people are very unfamiliar with. And it was like, not like, oh, what is this? Can I try it? It was like, my best friends were disgusted, you know? And fast forward, 15 years later, these are the guys that are ordering all these Korean dishes and, you know, they know more about it than I do. So I think now it's
like $30 dishes, like high end dumplings on the from a street cart.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They're the ones poking the holes in the
Xia Long Bao
dim song,
right?
And yeah. They're like, drink the soup first. Yeah, so it's,
they're telling us.
Like, yeah. What the fuck? But
have you had this before? Do you know how to eat this dumpling? Let me show you. Like, what? What is this role reversal going on? No, but I think to that point, this movie did a great job of saying, this is just, maybe this is today. This is where it's not weird. You know, I think, John, maybe especially with your kids, when they grow up, it's not going to be weird to be like, yeah, I've had this food, I've had that food. It's a completely multicultural kind of thing that we're living in. That's
for sure. And I also think in LA, we are, you know, we're ahead of that curve as well. And the rest of the world, or less, the rest of the United States, will also catch up in that thing. And there's that feeling of like that Ellie has in this movie of yearning, mm-hmm. of always looking forward, always feeling like out, and always needing sort of preparing for her future. And I just think that that's also something that I remember feeling a lot growing up, even to this day, even like now, that yearning of belonging. Mm-hmm. And how much that hurts. And you can go on, like, Ellie's very strong. Like, she's not a weak character. She's, like, doing her thing. Like, she can live her life. She's very functional, just like us. But in the quiet moments, when you see everybody, you know, having their friends and their things, and you feel like, well, where's my place in this?
Right.
And when do they see me as part of them? And when do they see me as not part of them? Right. Those questions are very, like, deep embedded into us.
So, I think one part of the story that I really liked is that, you know, when she was deciding, do I go to college or not, you know, there was this, I was like, of course you have to go, please go, please go. But there is this thing holding her back with her dad, and just this feeling of belonging. Because for her dad is probably the only place where she feels like she belongs, right? It's more of like her taking care of her dad is what it feels like in many ways.
Yeah.
But by the end of the movie, her having developed as a character, as a person, over the span of her senior year, to say, okay, I'm ready to take this on. I'm willing to face who I am and kind of embrace it. And the ending scene of her just on that train going forward, looking straight on.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very well, eloquently done kind of, you know, subplot to this character's development.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the movie's working for you when you are rooting for her and your heart is breaking for her every moment, especially that last train where you're so excited for her and also sad that she's leaving this place and these people. Mm-hmm. And then when her guitar, when her piano is out.
Oh my gosh. Somebody,
and then she, and again, Leah Lewis does an amazing job of making that feel very honest. And then he gives her that guitar and she can sing. And then after, she's like, the school loves her and she's at that party. But even at that party, they still say, like, it's the Chinese girl. Yeah. Like, the amount of times, like, my close friends say those things to me. And they're funny, whatever, fine in the moment. But then now you're like, that's fucked up. But then what are you going to say? And it's like that position you're put in.
Yeah.
Of like, if I say something, it ruins this moment. Yeah. But like, somebody needs to say something at some point, and I don't know when. And so I feel like we're always stuck in this awkward position of like, and then everyone's like, well, you never said anything and you didn't, you seem fine with it. Oh, my Asian friend loves it when I do that to them. And I'm like, whoa. Don't use me as an example.
Yeah.
You put me in a very weird, because if I say something, then I'm suddenly like, you're saying weird things. Anyway,
it's that token Asian thing. I just think that's
such a relatable.
Yeah, it's a token Asian thing. Like, I think what related to me with Ellie is like, Eddie and I went to we're very fortunate. We got to go to a private school, but we were one of very, very, very few Asians in this entire school. And it was just a very affluent community. We recognized we're very privileged to have gone there, but there were so many times where I was like, I don't belong here in any way. And we played that role of a token Asian so many times. And I think it's now that I've spent like close to 9-10 years in Korea, the way I process my quote unquote Asianness or who I am as a, you know, as a Korean American dude, there's nothing that like I shake or that I have any sort of insecurity on. But when you're growing up, that defines you. That really creates your persona and your personality. And I don't know. I don't know.
In a weird way, it's a reminder that you're, in a weird way, it is a reminder that they still see you as something else. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to process that because that would make you really sad. That would make, this whole thing a lie. And you cannot accept that this is a lie. Like, these are your real friends. And by the way, I don't necessarily blame them personally. I think I just blame the culture around that. Mm-hmm. And so I still love them. Now I know how to speak up without being Debbie Downer, but also educating some of these people. You also learn saying it once. If they're your real friends, it'll shut it down forever.
Right.
But when you're 13, 14 years old, it's really, really hard. And so I think this movie and other films that are coming out, and even YouTubers that are out there that that show like that the normalcy and that we're all just human beings, I just think it helps so much for a young kid who who always feels other, I guess.
For sure. I think one thing for Ellie that was really interesting is this longing of wanting more and of just trying to find herself and discover herself. And even, you know, as she makes the decision to go to college and leave everything behind, everything that she has now just seemingly gotten comfortable with and found a sense of belonging with, to have to leave that and go to college. John, have you had any moments or any similar situations where you've debated, do I stay, do I go, taking risks, or I guess throughout your life, professional experiences?
Yeah, a lot. You know, going to, I went to my school in high school and grade and middle school, one school the whole time, kindergarten through high school. So I never had to make new friends. I never had to. I mean, I go to like summer camps, but that's easy. But like, I was very used to being comfortable. And so going to LA was scary. Going into the film business with no connections was scary.
Yeah.
But I think I grew up in an environment, growing up in the Bay Area was also a huge blessing because everyone around me was changing the world. Everyone's parents were like engineers. It wasn't the way it is now where people are getting like crazy rich and are covers of magazines. These people are engineers that were making stuff that was changing the world and they weren't getting huge credit for it. And that was fine. And everybody, and so the environment was any individual person with a good idea and working hard can accomplish anything. And so coming to LA with that really helped protect me, I think. But that was hard. I was going away from my family. This was very close with each other. Everyone was coming, you know, is in the Bay Area. It was like a mile away from each other. And also just being here now, like knowing that I am now in LA and I'm going to be here. And I'm the one, my brothers and sisters all live still close together, that I'm the one out. I think about that a lot. But I know that I'm on a different mission than their lives of, and I need to get out there and spread the things that I learned from my family out to the world. And there's always an open door and always food on the table for me whenever I want to do that.
Amazing. Speaking of food, I feel like we have to talk about food real quick in this movie. It plays a very important role, and it plays a great role in Crazy Rich Asians as well. I feel like food is such a central theme to a lot of great stories. In this case, there's the dumplings, and there's also Paul's taco sausages and his family running like a sausage company, a meat company. I guess, how did you like watching that? As for people who don't know, your parents have, you know, a very, very famous Chinese restaurant in the Bay Area. And as the son of chefs and restaurateurs, what was it like kind of watching this film and the role that food played in it?
Well, I'm always watching food in movies just because I'm always hungry. I used to have better metabolism, so, but now, you know, I got to watch it a little bit. So, I think it just brings comfort. Like I smell that food, you know, when they're making the dumpling, I'm literally, it brings me right back. And also I don't see that as often anymore You know, now that I'm in LA and on my own family, like I don't know really how to do all that stuff. When you, the big thing is when you're the son of a chef, you actually don't know how to cook because you're always being cooked for. So it would, I'm ashamed, and I probably could have got a lot more dates if I knew how to cook, but back in the day. But no, I was naive to all that stuff. So I know how to eat really well. I just know how to cook. But when I see that stuff, I have a very, and even in my movies and Crazy Rich Asians and even in The Heights, when you see it, I was very focused, because when you talk to the Latinx community, when I talked to Lynn and Kiara about what they would eat and the sauces, you know, we had a lot of conversation of like, well, at a dinner party, you don't have it out there and they don't serve it. Usually it's sort of buffet and everybody gets it, all mixed match plates. And then also the sauces, someone would have like the proper sauce, and then someone would have one in their pocket that they had from home that they made at home. And so to me, those little details are so important. And there are certain pieces of plates and cups that you would recognize in any Chinese household. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's calendars on the wall from like the Chinese market that they got for free,
or
the plastic bags that they would keep so you could put other things in the, like, there's such details that I think evoke your own household. And then it also reminds you that, oh yeah, we all shared this experience with our parents who we thought it was unique, but it actually was happening everywhere. And there's a sense of unity there.
Absolutely.
But I loved how they used it in this movie. And bringing the cultures together too is such an American hot dog, you know, hot dog topping is like the most American idea, and mixing it in. So
absolutely. So I guess like in regards to this movie, you know, I guess like the overarching thing is just love. At the end of the day, this movie is about love, loving yourself, loving whoever you want to love.
And that love takes courage. You're willing to risk what they say, like the perfect portrait for the bold strokes. Mm-hmm. I love that line because I think I talk about that a lot when I'm making movies. Like as a director, everything should go according to plan. But as a director, you're the only one with the power to change everything like that. To say, actually, don't go through that door. Go through that window. And it changes the whole scene. Actually, we're not going to have any dialogue in the scene. We're just going to tell it through the train sounds that are outside the house. You're not going to be able to hear anything in the house. Mm-hmm. And that changes everything about that scene. And no one else, the producers can't change it. The studio can't change it. Only the director can look at that scene and say, let's do something crazy. Mm-hmm. And so I always look for those opportunities. But doing something crazy means if it doesn't work, you have wasted a lot of money for somebody else. So you better be ready to take that.
Sure.
So I love that concept of living your life in that way.
Did you have like a favorite scene in this movie? Like if you had to pick one.
Yeah. I mean, I had a lot. I love the sequence where they're, you know, when they're writing letters back and forth, but at a certain point where they have to do art on this wall. And each day they do a different piece. I think that was just brilliant and lovely and such a great way to communicate that. I also love the text message you see when he's in the cafe talking to her, and then Ellie's in the truck trying and texting her as well, Aster. And so there are these two different characters, and then he's messing it up. Just the sound effects in that are really funny. Two totally different conversations. The way they sit on the window when she leaves, once they actually like connect. Spoiler alert, they connect there. And then she's like, okay, I'm done. She goes to the back of his car and grabs her bike and then goes away. And the camera doesn't move. You see her get out of the car. You have to wait for her to get the bike in the back and you see her leave. It's just so much patience, but also evocative of that lonely feeling. You're not part of that. You're outside the party.
Right. That's so crazy. So like when I listen to you explain scenes, it's fascinating to me because they're like, as just a viewer, like those pauses or those awkward moments or that silence, we just watch it as like, oh, it's just awkward and silent. But for you as a creator, it's like, this is an intentional decision to not follow her with the camera, to make her walk around that car. Does that
because affect- I know someone is saying, "Can you cut it faster? Can you cut it faster?" And Alice and Alice has to be the one that says, "No, we're not cutting it faster." I'm like, why not? The movie's like getting long. Come on, let's go. And then she's like, "No, because for this reason, you have to be there with her.
I want to make you feel uncomfortable."
So, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
Paul is so good at that, by the way. Making you uncomfortable. Really
he's so being, good.
Like, just being dumb.
I really liked him.
He's so good at it.
But not being fake dumb. Like he feels like he's that guy.
I need to watch an interview with him to think otherwise, because I'm just like, he's playing this role way too well.
I always talk about movies like they're software. They're emotional software. So people, we have algorithms in our head that teach us to react to certain things, to certain colors and lights and movements and eye movements that make us feel stuff. And so we pay money and we go into this box, and then this flashes of lights flash in front of us, and it makes our brain release certain hormones or certain chemicals to make us feel things, to make us cry, to make us laugh. And so it is a series of lights and things that we're trying to, wherever we're coming from a fight, coming from waking up early in the morning, working all day, having our Coke sitting in a room, wherever you're from, we're going to guide you slowly into this path. And then once we get you onto our algorithm, now we have you, and we're going to make you feel all the things you want to feel. So by the time you leave this, you are going to have this sense of empowerment, this sense of sadness, this sense of whatever, wonder. And then you leave and you're either satisfied with that and it stays with you or not. And it either changes your future algorithm or not. I remember there's a speech where this guy has these black splotches and he says, "What do you see?" And the audience says, "Oh, I see I see islands, I see cats, I see this and that." And then he fades the other image behind it, and it becomes a coil of a snake. And he's like, "Now what do you see?" Everyone's like, "Oh, it's a snake." And then he puts the image back to what it was. And he says, "Now what do you see?" And the only thing anyone can see from then on is the snake. Mm-hmm. Because once you see things, you can't unsee it. Our brain is now programmed to see that. And I just think that that's the power of story. That's the power of empathy, that it is already in us to be empathetic. Yeah. And if we as storytellers show, people cannot turn away. And the more we show, the more they feel empathy for that culture, for those people, for that thing. And it comforts them that they're not also alone in their own thing. So a lot of this movie has that thing that I feel like is at the core of why we do what we do and why it's important that we do what we do. Because you can't unsee a relationship like this. You can't unsee Ellie Chu and feel for her and know that there is a girl, there is a boy in your life that feels those things. Mm-hmm. And how can you turn away from that? How can you be the villain of that movie? Mm-hmm. So I just think it's a very powerful movie. Stories are a very powerful program in our brains.
Amazing.
I can listen to John talk all day. Yeah. I can see why these studios pick it up. I can see myself in the pitch room. I'm just like, okay, like, my money.
Yeah,
take my money.
Whatever you want. I guess, you know, for the purposes of the show, you know, the show is called Commit or Quit, where we commit to the movie or we quit the movie. Obviously, I think you are committed to this movie. You chose this movie. But
yes,
if you had to make one short, concise, like, you have to watch this for this reason, absolutely, what is it?
Yes. It will make you smile. That's a very simple answer, but that's I think that's far and few between these days, or few and far between these days. So if you're here to feel good, you're here to see some truthfulness and what it feels like to be a teenager that's not the same old, this has all those ingredients.
Amazing. Eddie, how about yourself? Are you going to commit to this or are you going to quit it? What are you thinking?
Yeah, this is a commit for me. And this is something that I meant to touch on. But what I love, in addition to the music and that nostalgic 80s feel, because you'll catch me every time with some 80s music, is the fact that we don't even harp on her sexuality at all. It's just, it doesn't define who she is. It's just,
Even really talked about it here.
Exactly. It's just like, it's just a good story. It's coming of age. It's not overly harped on her being Asian and being like a misfit for XYZ reasons. It is just a feel-good movie, and I would highly recommend it. And John, that was a really, really good choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to commit to it as well. I didn't know anything about it going into it. And I had, I think I had like a glass of wine and I sat there and I was like, this just makes me feel warm inside. Like maybe it's the alcohol, but I think it's the story. It just felt good to watch. It was just enough nostalgia, just enough teenage awkwardness, just enough of this optimism of like, what does the future hold? So for me, it's definitely going to be a commit. So thank you, John, for bringing this movie to our show. I'm so glad that we were able to discuss it, mix it in with your life, our experiences, a little bit of everything. We don't want to hold you for too long, but before we let you go, we do have some questions that fans sent in on Twitter. So we have some for you, if you don't mind answering a couple of them.
Let's do it.
All right. So we talked a little bit about food, but this might be a very, very difficult question. This is from Forever Rain 88. I really enjoyed the scene in Crazy Rich Asians that captured so well a typical family coming together at the same table to help make dumplings. What is your favorite family meal? I'm so excited to hear this because I was researching your family and the food, and I was like, gosh, how delicious your childhood must have been.
Yeah.
We had some amazing meals over time. My mom and her sisters and our grandmother used to cook dinner every night when I was a kid with all the cousins and all the sisters. So that would be like almost 30 people at my house every night around a giant round table with a Lazy Susan, of course. And we had a dinner bell. So we'd all be doing homework at different parts of the house. And then we hear the dinner bell and we all had to gather. There was not enough room at the table. So other people would be on the stairs or on the floor. And those were some of my favorite meals because you could smell that food the moment you got home. My grandma would be making wontons, folding them or whatever. And so we'd have to come in and help her if she needed help. All our cousins would be home. You know, oxtail soup, whatever it was, like that there is a scent that you just feels like, oh, I'm home. And so I will never forget those days. And I now looking back, when I tell people that, it's very odd. People don't have those kind of dinners. So, and I certainly don't have those kind of dinners anymore. So, those were some of my favorite memories of food. And the other favorite memory is driving home from USC. I'd drive back to the Bay Area, you know, take me whatever, 6 hours. And when I got home, it would be 2 a.m. My dad would wait up and he'd be like, what are you hungry for? And he opened up the fridge and whatever we had in there, he'd make something amazing. And it would just be me and him. And that's when he became his chef again. And I got to have the best meal.
That's awesome.
Ever with him.
Quite different from my reality of just Hot Pockets every day. Not because my wife can't cook, but because it's just convenient. My mouth is watering just sitting here. It's like it's 5:30, so I'm like, it's dinner time. Awesome question.
Next question is from Show You Sean. I did a project presentation on Crazy Rich Asians. The whole movie's color palette is absolutely beautiful. As an aspiring director, what are some tips that you may have for other aspiring directors as I make my way through college to get there?
Ooh, loaded question.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Just a lot. I would say though, make stuff. It's the only way you're going to get better. You cannot become a director by studying directing. You can only become better director by making stuff and figuring out how to get the thing in your head into real life in front of you. And that takes communication. That takes learning technical skills of how to not just write, because I'm not the best writer, but I know how to like get images, how to collect images, cut them together, use music so I can communicate the story I'm telling to my crew, who then can take their skills and say, okay, I know how to do that. I will make my own version of what that is for you. And that will make you even look even better and smarter. And so communication and learning how to do that is only through and learning process of how things get made is the only way you're going to get confidence. And confidence is the only way you're going to overcome fear, and because fear is the biggest enemy for creativity. So the baseline thing to do is make YouTube videos. It doesn't matter, on your iPhone by yourself that nobody sees. It does not matter. Learn how to collaborate and make. And then the end of the day, you won't be asking someone for a job. They will be looking for you because they already have seen the stuff you make, and they're like, "I need that. I need that what you're making, and I need that." And so let me pay you to have some of that. That is the strongest position you can be in instead of waiting for a job.
Awesome. That's some great advice. Absolutely.
It's not the easiest thing to do. Nobody likes that answer, by the way.
It's just, that means go no one's do your come work. Help you. Work hard. And people are like, what? What do you mean?
Wait, I need to work.
And by the way, you know the people. You can tell the people who are going to do that because they're wired like that. You don't even have to tell them that. So.
I agree. Last question. This is from Sabi K. I am a huge dance nerd, been a fan of John's works in Step Up 2 and League of Extraordinary Dancers. So I was wondering how he approaches directing for music and choreography as opposed to spoken films such as Crazy Rich Asians. And has directing dancers influenced how you direct other projects?
That's a good question.
Dance is different. Because it's another language. It's a language of expression so words are a version of expression. Where you put the camera and how you light something is a version of language and expression. All the things that the audience are accepting and listening to. They're not just hearing words, they're seeing images and they're feeling sounds and they're put into perspectives and so all of those things are in play. When you add dance into that, it's just another way to get a nuance to what you're saying. And so you have to understand the dancer and the dance and the choreographer of what they're able to communicate. So I learned by accident. My friends were dancers. I was not a dancer. I hung out with them. And so I needed people to be in my short films. And they were the only people who would help me. And so because I knew them, I knew what they were trying to do with their dance. And because I knew film stuff, I would say, hey, I can do this to help you communicate that. And they were like, oh, cool. I was like, could you do something when I'm here? And they're like, yeah, I could do this to help you tell that. And so I got this language with dancers, all types of dancers, street dancers and classically trained dancers, that dance comes from a very rooted place in each person and has a different currency for each person. And I had to change my way of shooting according to each of those people. And so when you are doing that in a movie, you have to think of not just the actor, you have to think of the character. And then you guys have to work, you're writing a script together, essentially. It's not just the words, it's you, the choreographer, and the dancer themselves are writing a script live in rehearsals. And so you have to be there, you have to help craft that. And then you have to have it enough that when you're on the day of shooting, in the same way when you're in dialogue mode, you have to let it all go sometimes and see what happens.
Right.
And sometimes you'll get the best. You will actually almost always get the best stuff. But when you let go of the things you rehearsed and they do something in the moment, but because you guys are already on the same page, you know how to take advantage of that moment. And you catch a butterfly in a jar. And that's sort of the goal.
Oof, man. I feel like I could listen to you just speak for hours.
Yeah, can I ask you something just unrelated, more related to my profession? I feel like you'll have a good answer for it. I mean, that's awesome. That's really great.
You should hear what's in my head. I'm talking to myself all day long.
Well, John, thank you so much for such sincere answers to these questions. I know for a lot of people who don't have the opportunity to ask these types of things, it really means a lot to get these types of insights.
As I have time to talk about stuff. Sometimes, in all these forums, you get 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and you can only do the normal questions that everybody asks. When you have longer time, you get to dig a little deeper.
So, absolutely. We don't want to hold you for too long. We've kept you way over, I'm sure, what you had planned. But we really appreciate you spending time with us to introduce us to a brand new movie, to share your life story with us, bits and pieces here and there. And we just really, really appreciate it. Is there anything that we can look forward to from you? Anything that you want to plug? Anything you can share with us? Just to make sure
they should check out Home Before Dark on Apple TV+. Mm-hmm. I did the first two episodes, but I'm really proud of the whole show and And it's our first sort of foray into television. And then In the Heights, get ready for that. It's
been done
1 year. So, yeah, get hyped. I'm really proud of it. And I think it'll create a new lane for a whole bunch of people. So.
All right. Well, thank you again so much. We appreciate it. Please stay safe. Stay healthy. Hopefully we'll be able to hang out sometime soon when this is all over.
Let's do it in that Palm Springs Airbnb. That sounds good
too. All right. We'll do it. We'll rent it just so we can hang out here.
Okay, cool.
But thank you so much. Have a great weekend. And hopefully we'll connect again soon.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, John.
All right, peace.
All right, have a great weekend.
Bye.
Peace.
Bye. All right, guys. So that's a wrap on this special episode of Commit or Quit with John M. Chu. I hope you guys enjoyed our conversation as well as getting to know John and his projects a little bit more. Let us know what you think about the half of it in our discussion on it. And if you agree with the points that we made today, please be sure to tag us on Twitter at The Dive Studios to let us know your thoughts.
And be sure to subscribe to Dive Studios on YouTube at youtube.com/Dive Studios. Follow us on Instagram at The Dive Studios and follow us on TikTok. And also, most importantly, become a patron of ours at patreon.com/Dive Studios. We have some cool perks, full videos you can watch, opportunities to Zoom call with the team, etc., etc.
Yep. And lastly, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you're listening to us from, be it Spotify, Google, Apple, whatever it is. And if you could please leave us a rate and review on those platforms, we'd really, really, really appreciate it. So hope you enjoy this episode. Love you guys. Talk to you guys again very soon and see you on the next episode of Commit or
Quit.
Bye.
Bye.